Hey, Alex.
Hey Mark, how's it going?
Yeah, really good, thanks.
Well, thanks for joining me. I'm looking forward to this chat. I've been following your work and Sam's work for a couple years, and I see both of you as two of the leading sort of intellectuals and thought leaders in the, I don't even know if it has a formal movement, but I would say like the anti-virology movement. Is there like a kind of name brand that the kind of other leading thinkers like Tom Cohen and people like that have kind of bandied around? Is there like a name that you identify with?
No, I think sometimes you'll see labels like no virus or team no virus, etc. But I think no, I mean we're not part of some movement or anything like that. And Sam and I, Tom Cowan, Andy Kaufman, Mike Stone, Christine, all of these people, we were just doing this individually. We've all become great friends and certainly support each other. But I think it's kind of one of those funny things. It's like the term truther. I think it's kind of a dangerous term to put these labels on. And we do talk about the freedom community and stuff, but sometimes put it in quotes, because kind of
Well,
what does it mean?
the terrain idea seems to be like a common thing that people have bandied around, terrain theory versus virology. Is that accurate? Terrain, is that like the basis of the movement in some ways?
A little bit, but keeping in mind that the refutation of the virus model, it doesn't have anything to do with necessarily saying that you have to provide another explanation. We do attempt to do that, but sometimes people conflate that. And I've been in debates before where people then want explanations for things, and we're there to say, let's go through virology. And if we can refute the virus model, it collapses. We're not obliged to provide, a replacement for it. In many ways, it doesn't need a replacement. That's what people can't say. But yeah, I think the within the wider context, yeah, people like us and Tom Cowan obviously were trained in allopathic medicine and now pretty much speak out against about 90% of it, even though that was what we were trained in. And part of that obviously is virology. Within the wider context, it's germ theory. And within the wider context of that, it's allopathic medicine in general. And they're all related to each other because it's this model that they have of, it's a business model basically about saying what disease and health is. And then creating all of these institutions and so forth to monetize it basically and tell the population they need all this stuff. So, yeah, I think there's kind of, it's like an onion, if you like, of wider and wider considerations, but virology is one of the core features to the whole thing.
And just to explain to people, because I referenced it, what would be your simple like summation of the terrain approach?
Yeah, so terrain is really taking the approach that you things, and this applies not just to humans, but to animals and plants and the environment that we live in general, is that you don't see disease just, come out of the blue or whatever. There's always a reason for it, and it's because the underlying terrain changes. Now, that can be anything from soil to a plant, to a human, to a cow. All of them are under the same system of nature, where if something goes wrong, and there's many, many causes, they are quite simple, but they come down to deficiencies, excesses, psychological factors, particularly with humans, etc. Then once those things are disturbed, you get a problem with the underlying terrain, and then you'll get what we call disease and symptoms. And things like microbes, bacteria, and fungi, etc., they have no capacity to attack healthy tissue. There's no study shows that they just turn bad and start attacking us or the environment. But if the underlying conditions become deficient, then the microbes will move in, and that's when they proliferate. You know, we sometimes call it a cleanup crew, if you like.
I kind of think of it like the difference between the two is the typical model of health is very reductionist, where it's looking at it breaks up the body into individual parts and then attempts to diagnose things at the at this level of parts. And then the terrain view, which can be expanded out and incorporate other things. Like I'm a big fan of Chinese medicine, so there's some similarities between the two in the sense that you're looking at health at the level of the system, at the level of equilibrium in terms of how a system is designed to operate as a whole. And then when disequilibrium enters that system, that's when the conditions for disease and illness arise. But there's no corollary to that in traditional medicine because it doesn't look at things on the level of a system of a whole. Does that align with what you're presenting here?
Definitely. And we always go upstream rather than downstream, because we can show that by going downstream in models like the virus model, biochemistry, etc., is that ultimately you just end up with molecules, and it does not explain life or disease. Whereas we encourage people to go upstream, and we'd say to them, like, even if you take care of nutrition, and you know your body's you're not overweight and all those types of things, if you're in a state where you've got psychological distress, oh, that will eventually manifest as disease. I mean, and we know that it can be extreme. I mean, people can have grief reactions where they literally die, basically, because you know they're so psychologically distressed. So yeah, exactly. It's we point out to people that the chemistry set models that allopathic medicine, and particularly the pharmaceutical industry, runs are a dead end, basically. There's no health there, basically. There's just a business model. And yeah, there's many, many different facets to it, which we've spent years investigating.
You brought up a good point earlier that I'd like to revisit, which was the idea that to sort of critique and break down the flaws and the fallacies inherent in the supposed scientific justification for viruses and in many cases bacteria as a cause of disease rather than like a symptom or an effect of disease or even the existence of viruses in the first place, that that critique stands on its own without the subsequent need to like replace it with a valid answer. And what I mean by that, or what I'm trying to get at, is that I think what's happening here is a very needed shift of attention onto the philosophy of science. Because this the problems that we see here can be found in other adjacent scientific disciplines. And but the larger idea here is that we're in a, well, you know, supposedly we live in a scientific age, but we're actually in a crisis of science in which the science that we have that we call science is more of like a modern mythology promoted for, you know, political interests, economic interests, but it's not science done for the sake of sort of like human knowledge, human growth. So it's this very biased science. So in this particular field, I think people need to understand that how the philosophy of science works is it works by negation. And so it works by falsifying hypotheses. And as you continually falsify, then gradually what's left over, what has been falsified, becomes the criteria by which you build upwards. But the basic method of scientific development, as I understand it, is what you're doing with your work. And what the larger community here is doing, which is focusing in on all of the problems so that you can sort of negate all these theories about health and disease so that we can wipe, get them out of the way so that we can build ideas that aren't set upon a foundation of sort of non-scientific ideas or things that have been falsified or negated. So, I know that's not the most efficient way to make that point, but do you agree that that one of the main issues here is that we're discovering what actually science is and how the philosophy of science and the scientific method is actually intended to work?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, once upon a time, it was normal to put forward the null hypothesis and just say, look, we've come up with an idea, speculation, just some observations we've made, whether it's quote viruses or other things, and say, look, it's probably, we know that it's probably not going to be the case. So the null hypothesis is the most likely outcome here. And then we're going to test it though. We're going to run experiments, falsifiable experiments. We're going to invite others to critique our methods and results, etc. Going to get others to try and repeat things. That's how the science is supposed to work. And if the hypothesis is refuted, we don't then make a new excuse and say, this is probably why that didn't work, and let's move on for another decade or two and reinvent the model. And then that gets refuted, and then they say, well, that's because of this X, Y, and Z. Exactly. That's not how the science is supposed to work. And like you say, it's become a more like a type of mythology now. And what's really is disturbing is that, we're at the point where someone like myself or the wider community that questions things like the validity of the virus model, we can sit down with someone and say, let's walk through one of these papers and see if it follows the scientific method. And we can say to them, look here, first paragraph of the methods section, there's no independent variable. Where is
Right.
it? Because we would need one to do a scientific experiment. And instead of saying, you're right, there is no independent variable, they'll say something like, oh, this has been established elsewhere, or don't worry about that until we get to the results section, or it's not about one paper, it's about looking at all of the papers combined. And I mean, it's incredible, isn't it, that they've just said that they've admitted this doesn't follow the scientific method, but then they proceed to say that they are obtaining scientific information. And I mean, it's a very, like you say, this is not just virology. It extends into all areas, basically, now of science, where what we have is institutions and their high priests, basically, who tell us that no, this is the science, and it's not for other people to question it. But I know we find it unbelievable that it's so simple to show the complete logical fallacies that are being made. We show that the scientific method's not being followed. We show that they're even doing papers where there's no falsifiable hypothesis because they already start with assertions such as these proteins or these genetic sequences come from viruses, and then they proceed to do a paper. And you're like, well, that's ridiculous because you've started with an unfounded assertion. So nothing that follows on is valid. But yeah, this is honestly what we're dealing with. And I think what's happened is that just more and more people are waking up to this, and citizens are realizing, they're saying, yeah, what was I taught in high school? Or what was I taught about the scientific method? How do I run an experiment? And they can see now that all of this stuff involving virology and germs and pharmaceuticals and vaccines is all completely flawed. It's not scientific, and it's not scientific knowledge that's coming out of it.
My feeling is that part of the problems that people have and the sort of denialism that they go into when you begin to confront them with the breakdown of how flawed the science is because their sense of expectation is so deep in terms of associating sickness with a sort of material structure. Like it has to be boiled, like we were talking about reductionism earlier, like things have to be boiled down to some kind of tangible particle that you can visualize and you can picture the spread, like we can picture the spread of a particle coming out of people's mouths and you breathing it and infecting it inside you. It's like a very so we expect to see it. So when you try to bring people the idea that this expectation that they have and this visualization they have is actually in the imagination. It's a construct, but it's not a natural reality. Like people go into a type of like cognitive dissonance or a sense of denial about it. Because there is like overall, we do live, just talking about paradigms now, we live in a time of like materialism. And I feel like this area is sort of one in which this materialism plays out in the way that we look at health in the human body and nature as just the material structure and to not appreciate like the subtle energetic dynamics or the dynamics of wholeness that exist and how those interact with reality. So, I have a sense that what's going on here is deeper than just a more profound even than just we're being manipulated by a medical complex, which is true, but it's also true, I think, that this is like representative of a paradigm of a sort of an era of human civilization and era of human development that is very conditioned to look at the world in the way that the virology promotes.
Yeah, definitely. And we also, in the new book that we published, The Final Pandemic, we have a short prologue, which was, some words from Chris Hedges that he wrote in 2009. And that was, about how people are deceived. And he said, he made a comment that, technology and science doesn't necessarily mean that we can see things more clearly. Unfortunately, those institutions, if you like, that proclaim to be using them can use it to enhance the deception of the public. Because, yeah, if we come to something like a virology paper, most people can't read it if it's a technical paper. So they read the headline, which says SARS-CoV-2 isolated. They go, okay, looks like they did find it. They can't read the methods section necessarily and go, oh, that's interesting. There's no independent variable. They're just making assertions from the start that the sample contains a quote virus. They never actually showed that. And then they start sequencing and doing other tests, etc. But, and there was a time, even when I was a fully trained doctor in the system, where I wouldn't have been able to appreciate that either. I would have thought, okay, well, these guys are the experts. And this is what they've claimed, so that's probably right. And it wasn't until 4 years ago when Sam and I started researching this stuff and thought we better look into it for ourselves that we could see that this is not science. This is dogma, basically. And it was really disturbing because it wasn't a new thing. It had been going on for decades. And then we did more and more research and found out that people that had been criticizing these various fields, pharmacology, the drug industry, germ theory, virus hypothesis, etc., were all being suppressed, basically. They didn't want that side of the argument being put forward. And so, yeah, we don't have. Our universities and colleges are a disgrace now, basically. And I've talked to students in the last decade who, in the middle of a lecture, just questioned something, and they were completely put down and told to, that it's not appropriate to make those sorts of comments just for questioning some foundational belief that was being put forward. And you'd think, the universities, this is where these discussions should be taking place, but they're not. So, yeah, but in terms of whether this era is special or not, I don't know. It's, I think we look back through history and see these kind of periods that we go through seem to just be almost inbuilt into human society. And there's been plenty of times where, people questioning the narrative, if you want to put it that way, have been oppressed. And I guess you and I should be thankful that although people might get angry at us and write some smear articles, at this stage we're not being put forward for execution or imprisonment. So I guess yeah, it's always, I think it's always hard to say, like, whether this era is any worse than any others.
Well, one of the reasons I bring that up is that I feel like this age of materialism has sort of been with us ever since the dawn of the scientific age and has very much colored and influenced how science, the story of how science has developed. So the science really hasn't been given a full birth yet. Like we're still, we moved out of the age of like religious orthodoxy, but we didn't completely shed all of the bad habits that were associated with it. And so, the priesthood of old becomes this sort of scientific medical complex with the guys in their white coats, for example. So we displace things, you know, like there's certain elements that I noticed, you know, during the vaccine mania of a couple of years ago, where people were really looking for at these vaccines as like a source of salvation, almost like a vicarious atonement kind of theme with them. So there was a lot of old, like medieval type of psychological tendencies that still hadn't been fully worked through, and I felt like we're being projected onto this new scientific front. And so I noticed these themes. Well, another reason I wanted to bring up this idea of like kind of paradigms and materialism is that when you look at the history of virology and how it developed, particularly in the 1800, because if I'm not mistaken, the theory itself and many of the core ideas come from Louis Pasteur, who this is like at the very beginning of the scientific age. This is like late 1700s, early 1800s. Am I right? When like the formative ideas were being developed.
Pasteur was more late 1800s, you know, with Robert Koch and stuff, when they were really pushing
Oh, this is
the
okay,
germ
1800s.
theory.
But
Yeah, but
this is before they had the instruments to actually test whether these things they couldn't see at the level of what they proposed a virus existed in terms of like it wasn't until the 1950s really that they developed the technologies to actually look at a cell at that level of precision to be able to test whether or not this proposed virus existed. So for a long time, there was no way to double check this theory. So the whole science of and the whole industry of vaccines and the whole concept of sort of viruses and bacteria that has come to be institutionalized within science developed during a period when they couldn't the means to test them didn't exist. They didn't exist till way later on after this whole cottage industry had already developed.
And there's a number of problems with what happened. You know, the first was the original definition of virus, which stems from the Latin, and it just meant poison. Okay, and that's valid, obviously, because organisms like us and any other on the planet can get, you know, poisoned basically, and that's not a idea that's contested. We all know that. But then over time, you know, so with Pasteur and Koch and the you know, particularly the second half of the 1800s, they started, you know, saying that because microscope the light microscope had been around for a while then. You know, they were using it as early as the 1600s, and but they really in the 1800s started becoming interested in microbes, and they could see bacteria. They could see fungal cells under the microscope. And not only that, but the light microscope's great because you can see living tissue. You can actually see things moving and you don't have to do too many manipulations to it, you know. So, but anyway, in the late 1800s, they start saying that, you know, they put forward the germ theory, which is, talking about inappropriate science. It should not have been called a theory because it should have just been called a hypothesis. And you're probably aware of this in other fields of science when they call it a theory and then just quickly say, yep, it's a theory. There's a major problem because a theory in science is supposed to be a hypothesis that has withstood all refutations. So there should be no refutations of the theory in existence. And we know with germ theory that's preposterous because in the 1880s, Koch couldn't even establish it for any bacteria. So the famous Koch's postulates, you know. And like when I was a medical student, this stuff was taught to us like it was the absolute facts. And they said things like, you know, Koch's postulates, yep, it's valid. They said sometimes there are some diseases where it doesn't quite work out, but it's still overall it's valid, etc. And you look back at that era and we see with Pasteur and Koch that they didn't never established that pure bacteria would do anything. And we had other practitioners of the era, like Pettenkofer and co, who would demonstrate and would say, well, give me a vial full of your bacteria, something, you know, like cholera, say, Vibrio species. And they'd say, I'll swallow a pure culture and I guarantee nothing will happen. And people used to do this and they wouldn't get sick. And then they'd say, isn't this a problem? Because we just swallowed a whole lot of it and it didn't cause disease. And of course, they started making up various excuses as to why that might be. But yeah, so then moving from that, so they could actually see those things though. They could see bacteria, they could culture them, they could, purify them pretty nicely. They could run experiments on them, including against humans and animals. And but the whole thing should have fallen flat. They should have said, okay, it's not a valid hypothesis because, clearly the quote germs are on us and around us all the time. And the vast majority of us are not getting sick because of the germs. They're present, And but then they kept running with this hypothesis, even though they hadn't established it. And they started saying, well, sometimes we can't even see the bacteria or the fungal species, but the animal or the plant, the person is still getting sick. So there must be invisible, microscopic entities, even smaller than what we can see with the light microscopes. And then they started using terms. Sometimes you'll see just the term agent, this generic term. In the late 1800s, terms like fluid contagiosum started appearing. So they were implying that there was a contagious agent within the fluid that they were filtering, which excluded bacterial and fungal cells. So they were saying there's still something in there that's contagious. And then, yeah, it was, I mean, the whole thing was dead, basically, and they couldn't really establish this through scientific experiments. And even back then, they'd worked out that if they attempted to do control experiments properly with bacteria, it didn't work out for them. It refuted itself. And of course, with these so-called invisible things, which eventually they started calling viruses more commonly, they couldn't possibly do control experiments. It was not a thing because they couldn't separate it out and create an independent variable. So it never followed the scientific method. Then we got to the 1930s, and that was the introduction of the electron microscope. Now, of course, they're excited now because they're convinced that all they have to do is take tissue from animals or humans who are said to have a viral illness, whether it's, chickenpox or smallpox or measles, and now they're going to see these quote viruses in the tissue. And they couldn't. There was no difference between so-called viral illnesses, other illnesses, or just ordinary tissue. There was nothing they could see. So that sunk the hypothesis once again that they couldn't find these so-called particles. And they had the resolution, as you know, down to the nanoscale now. So yeah, again, the whole thing should have fallen flat. But then around 1948, they introduced the cell culture technique. Now they'd use this for other things, other types of you can propagate cells, and they'd been doing that for a long time, and they could run tests with bacteria, et cetera, and fungus species. But then they decide, well, now we'll just add samples of what they claimed had viruses in, so people's snot and blood, et cetera, and we'll add it to the cell culture. And if the cell culture breaks down, the so-called cytopathic effect, they say that that is proof that there was a virus in the original sample. And of course, this is a complete fallacy because they never showed a virus was in the original sample. They're now doing this roundabout process with no independent variable and can't possibly be controlled. All that it's working on, this is complete anti-science because the way it works is that they claim that the original sample must have had a virus in it if it causes cytopathic effects, and it didn't have a virus in it if it doesn't cause cytopathic effects. So you can see it, this is not nonsense. This is just circular reasoning. And they're in a paradigm where there's no in-ramp or off-ramp. It's just a stupid circular system. And I sent you my new paper,
Yeah, read it.
Virology's Event Horizon, which formalizes, I don't think anyone's quite expressed it in this way before. I wanted to formalize the logical fallacy about how you can't make a hypothetical entity real by conflating independent and dependent variables in the same experiment and by not identifying a separate entity at the start of the entire process. But I mean, as you know, though, that they've been using this process now since that period to claim that they are, quote, isolating viruses,
And
even when they
isn't it part of the technique of how they do the cell culture is they introduce toxins to kill the biological material that they're studying, and then once it dies, they're basically saying. So if I remember right, when you're creating the cell culture, they put something in it to weaken or sicken the cell, and then when they view the dead cell, they're looking at it has shed which I think are called exosomes, which is basically like cellular communication of a dying cell sends out these like very small particles, and they look at those particles from the cell that they've killed with the toxins they put in the cell culture, and they say, oh no, that's the virus, that's the legacy of the virus that came in and killed the cell. So it's like they've manipulated the whole thing. It's like they're reasoning from a conclusion that they've already made, which is that viruses are these deadly factors, and then they've manipulated the whole experiment in order to create this situation that justifies their preconceived conclusion, but the whole thing doesn't follow any kind of scientific legitimacy. And you can prove when you look at the steps that no, you just actually killed the cell, and what you're looking at is not the cause of the death in terms of these exosomes. These aren't the viruses. These are the remnants of a dead cell that you've killed because of the way that you conducted this whole experiment.
Yeah, exactly. There's a whole lot of problems here, and the yeah, I don't necessarily call them exosomes because there's a problem with the electron microscopy technique, and that is that it's not looking at living tissue. So what it's looking at is a sample that's been dehydrated, treated with chemicals, embedded in resin, sliced incredibly thinly, and then placed under the beam to create these indirect images. So whether or not that even represents reality in a living tissue is another question, because I'm not sure if you're aware, but there was a biologist, Harold Hillman, who wrote extensively about this stuff, about electron microscopy and other techniques in the lab, and said that they're not controlled in themselves. How would you control these techniques and show that it relates to what actually happens in nature? And for most of these things, you can't. They're completely uncontrolled and involve a whole lot of inferences. So what I would say is that what they are presenting in their electron microscopy images, I just say, look, they are vesicles or vesicular structures. Most of the time, they can't characterize them, so they don't even know. They could guess and say, look, they seem to have a protein shell and possibly some genetic material on the inside, but there's no way they know what the significance of that vesicle is. And like you, I think it's probably just some sort of cellular breakdown product. It could be a messaging system. It could just be the way that cells break down and fall apart, and the material is just then recycled in a, you know, it's packaged up and used again. There is zero evidence that that particle has any capacity to cause disease, because that's what they're saying. They're saying these appearances in the cell, these particles that appear to come about, are what made you sick, or what's causing an infection, or what is able to replicate all of these things. You can't determine that, because, and it's always the giveaway if you read one of their papers, if you ever see one of these images and it says something like virion budding off from the cell. Well, how do you determine that? It's a dead image. That's not a living image. You can't say that it's budding, because that's a verb that makes out that something you've observed happen, but you haven't. You've just taken, you know, a snapshot of it and then inferred all these different things. But I mean, it goes deeper, yeah. Because the process itself, and this has been demonstrated a couple of times now in history, is that you can just take the cell culture and add the antibiotics and antifungals and passage the cells, which puts them under stress, and eventually they start breaking down. Eventually they can produce new sequences, and this is not appreciated seemingly by the virologists, that in the 1960s, Barbara McClintock worked out that you can take cells including, mammalian cells, complex cells, put them under stress in a test tube, and new DNA sequences start forming, not just RNA, this is DNA. So that implies that the genetic material of the cell is actually able to change because it gets stressed. So you can see all of their models regarding genetics, et cetera, need to be thrown out the door. But what it comes back to with the cell culture process is, and that's what my recent paper really tries to emphasize, is that you can't possibly control it because there's no independent variable. It doesn't matter. You can't claim that, oh, this one I got from a healthy person and this one I got from someone with measles, and here we go. We'll run them in parallel and see what happens. That's not valid either because you've already made assumptions in two directions. One is that the quote healthy specimen doesn't have viruses in it. The technique is unable to determine that. The second assumption is that the measles one does have viruses in it. You can't make that assumption either. You can't make the technique itself can't make that determination. So the I think yeah the technique refutes itself and is so we can see it's so problematic, but you can see the overriding problem is that you can't control the experiment. There's no independent variable. Compare it to say if you had bacteria, you might have some E. coli. You could purify those cells really nicely and then put them in the cell culture. Or you've got some arsenic, and you've got a vial of it and you've constant it's pure. The chemists would say, yep, that's a pure vial or as close as we can get of arsenic. Put a few drops in the cell culture, see what happens. Now that's an experiment where you can control it. But yeah, the virologist is this is just a world of pseudoscientific make-believe. And that's why I say that, most people would read these technical papers and they're written in a very arcane language sometimes. It's purposely designed so that the public can't really understand it. But once you see through it, it's so obvious that they have nothing. They have no scientific foundations to the whole thing.
Yeah, another, one of the reasons or one of the ways that it became easy for me when I started to go into this field and learn more about viruses for me to accept immediately the problems in it. I mean, I did have some background in the philosophy of science. I mean, my academic training is in the social sciences, but the scientific method, nonetheless, I was familiar with how it works, so I could see where it departed. But I also spent a lot of years studying system science, a field called system science. And for anybody who's unfamiliar with that is, that's basically this interdisciplinary field that tries to define what the basic pattern of life is as it manifests at different scales, where it could be an organism, it could be nature as a whole, it could be a solar system. But there's this basic dynamic of certain requisites that a thing has to have to be defined as a living entity. And the so the and the basic idea is simple. It's that a living entity is a wholeness that is comprised of component parts that interact in such a way that they reproduce the whole structure as a wholeness, the whole entity as a wholeness. So this happens through time, and that's part of the definition of a living organism, is how this process works at various scales. But there's certain similarities at each level. And in the realm of biological life, the smallest sort of unit that we see this manifest in is the cell. Is the absolute simplest form is the single cell organism, like a bacteria. But a virus, the virus construct doesn't fit any of these requirements. So it's this idea of something that has the properties of life as it's defined, but it doesn't actually, in terms of like it's said to sort of move as a parasite and occupy a thing and kill it for itself and then move on to another host or whatever. But it's this completely illogical thing because you look at what a virus actually is. It's supposed to be. It's several orders of magnitude smaller than a cell, a bacterial cell, and it has none of the internal dynamics that qualify it to be judged as a life form. So it's this idea that's really like a zombie. It's this inert package of cellular material that's supposedly moving with intelligence and moving from one thing to another, and the whole thing is just completely illogical when you look at it on the level of like system science.
Yeah, I totally agree. But the problem with dealing with that is that it's quite hard to sometimes approach that with the technical stuff. And it's much easier for us just to refute their experiments
Right.
and show that they're completely wrong. Because I know what you mean. To me, understanding, having come through the allopathic system and fully trained in it, it makes no sense to me anymore, so much of that paradigm. And, yeah, I agree. This whole thing, it would be a nonsensical notion, I think, once you have an appreciation of how life and nature works. But don't get me wrong. I know. I think it's a completely valid point. It's just more difficult because what they will argue is that, virologists will say, no, it's not a living particle. It doesn't fulfill the definition of a living organism. And but they'll say, but this is how it works. It gets in the cell here, it's got these properties here, these proteins, it's got these genetic sequences which are able to incorporate themselves into the cell and cause replication, etc. So although I completely know what you mean, for us, we've just found it much easier to attack the papers which deal with quote isolation,
Right.
genomics, PCR, proteomics, antibodies, contagion, animal studies. We just attack it on those fronts. And we can show on all of those fronts, we can refute what they've produced. And as you know, we really only have to refute it on one front. If we do that, the model collapses because
Right.
once it's been refuted, it can no longer stand. And I
Right.
think coming back to what we were talking about earlier was that this is not being appreciated, that the virologists are saying, oh yeah, well that's been refuted, but let's just move on to the next thing. And I've even, I mean, these are often a waste of time, but over the years I've done a few online debates with people who support the virus model. And I mean, it's so crazy that you refute a whole thing about what they're saying, a whole aspect of isolation or genomics, and then they move on to the next thing. They don't then say, oh, got it. Yep, that aspect's been refuted. Therefore, the model now collapses. Instead, they go, oh, let's move to another aspect
Right.
where hopefully we can, keep this model alive.
Right. Yeah, it and then there's another element of this which has been done but with people like Christine Massey, I think her name is, but her approach was to do freedom of information requests from all these governments, particularly in the COVID situation, being like, okay, you say that you've isolated a virus, let's see those papers. Let's see your proof that you've isolated a COVID virus. And then no one can produce them.
Yeah, absolutely. And it is important. Like we know that people say, oh, it's just the way she's wording the questions or all of this kind of stuff. But no, what Christine's done is absolutely vital. And when I wrote a farewell to virology, which is my formal treatise I wrote in 2022, and that refutes the entire virus model. That's why I opened in the first few paragraphs by talking about Christine's work, because this is the thing that people, the wider public, need to appreciate. They don't find viruses in human tissue or animal tissue or anywhere. They never do. And so, and people say, people try and dismiss that, but isn't this like incredible? Like, to be honest, when I was a doctor in the system, I didn't know that. I assumed like that they could take a blood test and check if you had HIV in there or check if you had some other, Epstein-Barr quote virus, all this kind of stuff. But no, it's really, really important. And the other thing Christine has done, and her website just is a great resource, she gets responses from all of these institutions and some of her colleagues. And I feature some of these responses in A Farewell to Virology. They simply ask, can you like tell us what the control experiment was or how you controlled the experiment? And either they completely won't tell you and make up an excuse, or they divulge something which is just incredible. Like, the Peng Zhu paper was one of the first four out of Wuhan back in 2020, claiming that there was this new quote coronavirus. And they admitted, one of the authors admitted that they treated the cell cultures differently. Like they put different amounts of antibiotics in. It's just incredible that you think that publication should have been withdrawn on that alone.
Right.
It should be have been taken out of the mainstream peer-reviewed journals, but no, it's still there and it's still cited as evidence of SARS-CoV-2. So, you know, it's really important the work that Christine's done, and it's she's expanded it into bacterial fields as well. So, for instance, now she's contacting the CDC and other institutions and saying, "Can you just show us one controlled study, experimental study that shows that this bacteria causes disease in a human or an animal?" And universally, the response is, "We don't have any." And then they try and, you know, gaslight people and say, "But, you know, this was discovered by Robert Koch back in the 1880s." And
Right.
we say, "No, it wasn't. We've read those papers. That wasn't established at all." So, yeah, Christine's work is her endurance and getting, she's got hundreds and hundreds of responses from these institutions and just confirming that they do not have evidence of any, quote, pathogens. So nothing, no evidence that bacteria cause disease, that fungus causes disease, and certainly no evidence that viruses do, because they can't even provide evidence that viruses exist.
That's right. Yeah, so people should know if there any listeners are new to this topic, like how comprehensive the coverage of and the takedown is of like kind of traditional allopathic medicine that's grounded in this idea of germ theory, whether that be viruses on one hand or even bacteria on another. And so, you know, part of that takedown is what we were just talking about, Christine Massey with Freedom of Information, showing that there is no evidence that these people who say that they have proof, they don't actually have proof. Then there's takedowns like yours, where you're dissecting the scientific method and showing all the logical fallacies and how it doesn't hold up to scrutiny. And there's, you know, books that can go one by one through various illnesses that are traditionally associated with viruses or bacteria and show how actually what we have thought was that what people assumed was the illness was being caused by this is actually caused by something else. And so there's like a substitution taking place. And in some cases, I think a deliberate masking where you're putting like something like polio, where you clearly the pattern of illnesses, you look at in the 50s or when the polio outbreaks, quote unquote, originally took place, it was like, no, people were getting poisoned by things like DDT. And then they were masking that by saying it was an outbreak of a virus, essentially. So AIDS, you could look at that as well, that there was people were having this immune system collapse happening for different reasons, and that there was this substitution of a virus narrative. But like anywhere you any possible angle you can take on this has been taken, and like it's a total complete victory for the critique of virology and the overall germ theory paradigm. Would you agree with that assessment?
Yeah, totally. And I think people often underestimate how detailed the critiques are now. And for instance, recently a group in the Netherlands reached out to me because they said that they had a guy that wanted to debate me over the existence of viruses. And I said, okay, I said, I don't have a lot of belief that this will be a useful exercise. And I said, I don't think that these people usually actually look at the work that we've done. So I
Right.
said, can I just meet the mod? I agreed to meet the moderator for a meeting on Zoom. And I start talking to him. And within 10 minutes, his whole expression changed. He could see that there was so much detailed work had been done against the virus model. And he was just completely unaware of it. He'd only heard the kind of mainstream virology. So he didn't know about any of our publications, whether they're the technical papers or books, etc. He didn't know about work like the Perth Group and Stefan Lanka, etc., that had been done over the decades. So, yeah, it is. It's a lot of people don't realize that the arguments are incredibly well developed. And yeah, it's the few times I've done these online debates with people, they're not aware of any of the work that we've done going into it. And I think they're always quite surprised how easy it is for us to respond to whatever they want to talk about, whether
Right.
it's cell cultures, genomics, anything, antibodies, animal studies, epidemiology. We've covered it all, and every aspect has been refuted. So Yeah, it's really just an awareness thing, and I think we're really moving into a strange situation where we're getting a lot of feedback from people that have been awake for a few years now and realize that there's no germs that are out to get them, that viruses don't exist, all this kind of stuff, and that but they can't talk about it with friends and family because their friends and family are still in the old paradigm and the false paradigm. And I think it's true. I mean, we encounter that all the time as well. That's so deep into believing that whole thing that the moment you start talking about it, they really just switch off and think
Right.
that this is crazy. What are you talking about? Everyone knows that viruses are contagious and cause disease. They just can't get beyond that.
Yeah. If you see that, it's interesting. I mean, there's clearly a motive for people who work within, have careers or have some kind of ownership stake in this in the perpetuation of this industry, like how they would be in denial about wanting to acknowledge the work that's been done here. But in the health freedom movement, it can be frustrating to see people who are there to critique what happened with COVID, but can't make the full step into acknowledging actually it's the whole paradigm is the problem. It's not just that there was corruption happening here, it's that the whole paradigm is corrupt from the very foundations of it.
Yeah, exactly. And we, in general, we don't go attacking other people in this quote freedom community who have been speaking out against COVID. But when they come out and attack us, or when they start saying that SARS-CoV-2 is real and that it's a bioweapon and all this kind of other nonsense, we will
Right.
respond to that because I think it's reckless. And what's becoming apparent is that a lot of people are just running their own kind of marketing campaigns, if you
Right.
like, because what they're doing is saying that, oh yeah, the vaccines are no good and the responses were all wrong, but my protocols are the best and I know how to treat this and
Right.
I've got the products which treat COVID-19, etc. And this is just again, this is just a complete sham. It's just taking them off one wrong paradigm and into another. And to be honest, yeah, it has been disappointing because, as you know, people like us, Sam went public in 2020 as soon as we understood that virology was fraudulent. And she started producing content back in early 2020. And these days we people in the even in the so-called freedom movement they don't really acknowledge that people like us were out saying in 2020 it was a complete scam. And now they're sort of saying, oh, yeah, we know it was a fraudulent pandemic and we know the PCR's got problems, etc. But again, they're not going the full distance and explaining what actually happened and that the whole thing was a fraud. There was never a pandemic at all. All they did was sent out a new PCR test and then an antigen test amongst the population and just reclassified illnesses that were pre-existing. So
Right.
I know, and it's we've tried to engage with many of them, these prominent people who continue to say that viruses exist. Some of them we've presented to for several hours and they don't refute anything. They offer no refutation. But then a few months later, you see them again just pushing forward the virus model and that COVID was real and all this kind of stuff. So yeah, it is. It's disappointing to see. And like you say, it's like they can, I don't know what it is. They get to a certain point where they say, oh yep, the vaccines are a fraud and the antivirals and quote are a fraud and they don't need face masks and all of this. But when we show them that our arguments are far more developed than anything else out there about why there is no contagion, no viruses, etc. They seemingly just want to completely ignore that, or even worse, just do derogatory stuff. You get these characters like Steve Kirsch who just started running smear articles, and we tried to help the guy. We sent him, Sam offered him a free copy of Virus Mania. I offered to talk to him early on to clarify things. But instead, he just wanted to run with smear articles saying that we're We don't know what we're talking about, that we don't have any material and all this kind of stuff. And it is a shame because some of these people have quite significant audiences and they're keeping them in the dark. Although I think increasingly it's getting difficult for them to ignore the whole virus existence issue. And we're seeing, I mean, a lot of them are just lashing out now and getting really angry because I think the audience is pushing them and saying, why do you keep espousing this stuff? I mean, the virus model's kaput. And so instead of actually engaging with the material, they just are stuck in ad hominem kind of mode, or they're using anecdotal stories, etc. And but I mean, I think it's one of those things we can only wake people up so much. They have to choose to look at this material, just as people like you and I had to look at it initially and say, okay, we're prepared to admit that we might have thought some wrong things in the past, and we're open to looking at some new evidence.
Yeah, I mean, what because what you're really confronting here is a real it is a change in paradigm. It's a fundamental change in thinking, and it's a violation of a deep-rooted expectation of how people think the world works, how they think so like kind of goes back to what I was trying to say at the beginning. There's like a bit of there's a theme to it that's like characteristic of the age. Like it doesn't surprise me that people have this attachment to this very kind of materialist reductionist view, because that's the mode of psychology that it defines the present era. Like when people 1,000 years look back at this point in time, they'll say like that mode of thinking is one of the dominant character traits of humanity during this period. And so what this particular issue with viruses is one of these arenas where that breakdown in the old way of thinking and the introduction of a whole new concept of health and life and sovereignty and things like that are coming on board. But it's like it's such a shift in view. It's like there's something that has to happen. There's some kind of attachment that people have to let go of in order to accept that reality. And I think the people that are trying to hold on to this germ theory paradigm, just there's something within them that's just not ready to make that big lift into like a new mode of thinking.
Yeah, and absolutely, and you have to think what we're up against here, because the whole concept of contagion and these things like quote pathogens and viruses, they are acquired for the biosecurity surveillance state. So,
Right.
and that's also the danger. And we try and point this out to people who do promote this stuff, that have you not thought what the end result is here? Because if they're saying that not only do viruses exist, but people can engineer them in labs and make all sorts of weapons with them, they're not going to say, oh, the public can sort that out amongst themselves. They are going to say we need stricter biosecurity state measures, and they'll put even more restrictions. And we saw that in the COVID era. I mean, people weren't allowed to travel. Like in places like New Zealand, where we are, if you didn't take the jabs, you couldn't get out of the country unless you hired your own. You could charter your own jet, etc. But that's cost is usually in the hundreds of thousands to get to do that from New Zealand. So for the average person, they couldn't do that. There was no escape, basically. So they're on an island and told you can't leave because you until you have this jab that Pfizer's made for you. So we have to remember, yeah, this is one of the most effective ways to control the population. And it's all based in that fear narrative. So if people are scared, they will do, what governments say. And you have to think, back to, March 2020, when countries like ours went into these really severe lockdowns and stay-at-home orders, why did people go along with it? I mean, there was no way they could enforce it. I mean, we know that because our family and plenty of others just did whatever we wanted. They don't have enough police to come and check you and all this kind of thing. But 99 plus percent of people went along with it. And they went along with it because they were scared. They actually thought that they might, quote, catch something and it could kill them or their grandma, etc. So I think a lot of it's based in fear that people think, well, what if there are these things? And, what if I do get them, etc.? So with that, we have the entire state apparatus
Right.
and the mainstream media, the pharmaceutical industry, the biotechnology industry. They all want this narrative because it is such an effective way to control the population. So, I mean, I think that eventually the germ stuff will, too many people will know about it and they won't be able to use it as a fear narrative. I think at that point there'll be another narrative, like, as you know, they'll move to the climate one or some sort of environmental thing.
Right.
They'll say, oh, yeah, we'll forget about the germs. That's all under control now. And because, I mean, if you think about it, I mean, even for people, I just point out to them, don't, for people like myself who were kids in the 1980s, I mean, by that point, you know, I don't believe in infectious diseases, obviously, that's not how it works. But so-called infectious diseases by the 1980s were a complete joke. You know, kids, I went to schools where no kids died, hundreds and hundreds of kids over a decade, not one death, you know, or there'd be one death and it would be the result of some terrible car accident or, you know, bike accident or something. But nobody was dying of any of these diseases, which you know used to wipe out a significant number of the population going back, you know, into the 1800s, etc. So, I mean, this is all the whole concept of infectious diseases was almost a joke by the 1980s. But then, of course, they launched the HIV scam and said that that caused AIDS, etc. And people
Right.
started getting scared again. And but obviously, by the year 2000, the whole HIV thing had fizzled because people realized that this is not, nobody's getting it virtually. It's only a tiny group of people. And again, people were like back to going, oh, it's not really a thing.
Right.
But, you know, somehow with COVID, they managed to get this fear narrative back into the population. And I honestly think that's probably, you know, why people can't let go of it, because it's pushing these primal, you know, emotions that people have, and the ultimate one is that they'll die, that their mortal body will die. And I think that's why germs have been so effective. And you know, people are scared about tales of the Black Death, and they're impressed with stories about how smallpox blankets, you know, wiped out hundreds of thousands of people. And there's no evidence for any of this, but those kind of myths really do propagate fear amongst
Right.
people. And so, yeah, in regard to what you suggest, I would say that the fear element is the one that we have to get people to overcome. And when they do, it's amazing. Like the feedback we get, like Sam's inbox is always full each week of people who say, oh my goodness, I used to be so scared of, quote, catching things and germs. And, you know, I used to get the flu jab every year and all this kind of stuff and take some antibiotics. And now they say, I realize just it's a total scam. And they said, you know, now I've been off all of that for a couple of years. I don't fear, you know, being around the environment. I don't fear being around other people. I know that they are not the reason I'll get sick, etc. And their health is just, you know, soaring because of that. So, I mean, it's like we're bringing the good news, basically. We're saying that you don't have to worry about this. This is not why you're getting sick. And yeah, but I think the media and the governments, they are going to push this as hard as they can, because, I mean, as you saw, it's pretty difficult to control entire populations. But I mean, I'd never seen anything like it in 2020 when
Right.
whole cities were deserted. I mean,
Right.
even New York was, you know, I saw pictures where there'd be one or two people walking around. You're like, what else can do that apart from irrational fear?
Yeah, you made a number of points that I want to follow up on. On the level of fear, I have to have it here. I did a publication. I haven't done too much with it. I want to re-edit it and get it on Amazon. But it's called, I put this out in fall 2021. It's called Psychology, the Science of the Soul. And the point of this was to, well, there was two points. Number one was to go over the basic ideas of Carl Jung's philosophy and the way his model of the human psyche worked. And one of the most important aspects is to look at the unconscious and the realm of and well, the unconscious is something that is fundamentally collective. So it's this idea that the human mind is not just isolated into the body. That's one dimension of it, but there's another dimension that we all share in common, which is our connection to the field of the collective unconscious. And so the collective unconscious is home to these forces he terms archetypes. Plato termed them archetypes as well. And these act as these elements that have this sort of like they come from within. They have almost like a top-down force within us, but there it's a non-tangible, but it expresses itself as the activation of certain very primal emotions. And if you're not aware of that, then you tend to project those out into the world and engage with the type of shadow projection. And what's interesting, one of the things and I'll send you a copy, a PDF of this. One of the interesting things about his work that a lot of people don't know, and that some of his followers, one of whom is a guy named Stanislav Grof, who I talk about in here, is that he was very interested in astrology and how the traditional science of astrology, very ancient esoteric science, how it constellates with his view of the unconscious. And so he had a number of interesting papers towards the end of his life talking about astrology. And some of his follower fo people who followed him elaborated on this. And so what in this publication, one of the things I do is I look at the astrology of 2020, 2021, and look at the planetary alignments with the idea that these alignments will manifest through the collective unconscious and act as these types of mass psychological events. So this is like a different way of approaching the idea of like mass formation psychosis that became kind of a thing that people were talking about a while back. So it's like dealing with that same issue, but approaching it from a Jungian standpoint. And in particular, there was a alignment of Pluto and Saturn that on in 2020 and 2021. And so in this, I go through like some astrological books that talk about what are the archetypal themes that would come out during an alignment like this. It's a relatively rare alignment. And it is exactly the themes that were expressed in that 2020 period where people really lost their minds into fear, into shadow projection, into scapegoating. And so it's like that whole period is like a case study for looking at these deeper ideas about psychology and how they inform like the human behavior on a mass scale. And so anyway, that's an aspect of this study that has not yet of this whole angle on like understanding what happened during 2020, what happened with this COVID like pandemic, why do people act the way they did? Like this whole Jungian angle is not something that's really taken root in the culture, and I'd like to find some way to like bring this out because it's a real game changer in terms of like paradigm changing discoveries about like what happened and what it tells us about ourselves. So I just wanted to point that out. My listeners will probably know about this, but not many people outside of the people who follow my podcast know about this. So it's a is this something that you've been familiar with at all, or were you aware of this angle on things in terms of the unconscious and also this astrological angle on what was happening in 2020?
Yeah, definitely. One of our friends is the investigative journalist Eric Coppolino in New York, and so Eric talks a lot about this stuff, and that's one of his specialties as well. But yeah, I mean, definitely. And we always point out to people that there was no biological event, if you want to talk about that, that took place in 2020. There's no basis to that. We've broken that down. There's no SARS-CoV-2. There's
Right.
no new disease, etc. All that kind of stuff. So something else was going on. Now, definitely, it's in a wider framework, and not only the concepts you talk about, which are at the highest levels, but also we have to think about the worldwide situation going into 2020. You know, we had the imminent collapse of many financial systems.
Yes.
We've got a whole lot of problems going on with, you know, superannuation schemes, you know, Social Security. They're not sustainable systems, and they're all going to collapse. So we've got all these problems that are starting to brew up. We've got a whole lot of, you know, crazy stuff going on in schools and with young people and social media, etc. So yeah, we always look at it and say, look, this is just what we look at with the COVID situation, with germ theory, with viruses, etc. It has to be considered with those wider concepts, and it just keeps getting wider and wider. until you do get into aspects such as you're talking about, like what seem to be mass psychological events. And I mean, people have talked about this for centuries, that whichever particular system, psychological or spiritual, that people believe in, there do seem to be these periods where we go into a phase of very low consciousness, or whatever you want to call it. And 2020 seemed to be one of those times when people were just happy. Well, not, I don't know about happy, but just, to go into tyrannical type arrangements in society without hesitation. And I think it's interesting now to see those people who went along with it, who either are not dealing with it at all and are just pretending like nothing happened, or are saying that, it seemed to be the right thing to do at the time. And I think they're not dealing with it in that regard either. But yeah, totally. I mean, we get asked a lot about the wider picture, and we say, yes, we're definitely aware of it, but we can't research every topic, obviously. And we've ended up specializing in the aspect of health and disease, and particularly looking at breaking apart this allopathic paradigm, and which is, you could argue that the allopathic paradigm is one of the greatest scams ever pushed on the population, and it's been going now for at least 100 years, and has completely distorted their entire idea of health and disconnected them from nature. So I don't know, whether the psychological themes you're talking about relate to that as well. The fact that the medico-pharmaceutical complex and these quote health systems and allopathic medicine in general has disconnected people from the environment. It's disconnected them from each other and made people think in terms of these fear-based narratives that we've talked about.
I talk about this a lot in some of my work, in terms of this idea of the Kali Yuga, which is like a dark age or an age of materiality. And I've done a lot of work tracking like when what the onset of the Kali Yuga is. It's traditionally held to be around 3100 BC, and how that led to the decline of an early age of states, and then the rise of this, basically the rise of oligarchy, and how that sparked the rise of empires like the Greek Empire, and then later the Roman Empire. And so and then also the change in psychology that was happening across the world in terms of a move towards a more secular mindset, more materialism, and sort of more of these long repressed drives coming out and causing chaos all over the world. And there's different ideas about how long the Kali Yuga is supposed to last, but one of the predictions was around 5,000 years, over a little over 5,000 years. So if you go from 3100 BC moving forward a little bit over 5,000 years, what's implied is that we might be experiencing the culmination of this long subcycle of a type of dark age. So right as we're moving towards the cusp of like world civilization, we see these long building themes of sort of like darkness, materiality, egotism, materialism, selfishness that build up incrementally over the past 5,000 years are now sort of playing themselves in a very concentrated way within like the human psyche. And so like as we're on the cusp of this great breakthrough of world civilization, that we're having this great confrontation with the shadow and all the different elements that are involved with that. But geopolitically, the shadow is this deep state, is the military industrial complex and its branches of banks and cartels and things like that, that the allopathic medicine scheme has always been a part of and locked into. And so that's one of my feelings is why has this sort of like prostitution of science been allowed to perpetuate for so long that's associated with the germ theory? And that's because it was always from the very beginning associated with these cartels that were linked, and particularly the name Rockefeller is very prominent in terms of how they were founded, how the whole industry was founded, and also the role that they played in like US empire, developing US empire, that we're looking at something that became too big to fail, where you couldn't have the feedback loop come back in and like course correct the nature of science. And so this like cancer was allowed to grow. And at a certain point, I think empire came and said, hey, we can weaponize this further. And, you know, we can use this like misplaced belief that so many people have in this theory, and we can, you know, weaponize it towards our own ultimate ends, whatever those may be. And so we're, you know, world control and eugenics and all that stuff. And so I think over the course of the latter half of the 19th century, that, you know, it wasn't just business corrupted it, but now this other deeper force of empire came in, and they began to use it towards like a larger end game. And I think the AIDS thing that in the early 90s was like phase one of that. And then the COVID thing was the big play out, because as you were saying, the whole COVID pandemic came around a time when all these other major events were taking place in terms of world order, you know, financial crisis, economic crisis, major geopolitical moves. And so many things were able to take place under the guise of this shutdown and lockdown. And part of that was this like systematic preying on the population's unconscious fear elements in order to drive this home. So yeah, we're looking at, you know, so basically this whole thing we're talking about, you have to look at in many different layers, you know, and then the whole picture comes together only when you build out all the different elements and you can look at them all as like a synthesis.
Yeah, absolutely. And we've talked about this before. And the aforementioned Eric Coppolino's noticed this as well, that if you tried to pull off COVID, say in the 1960s or 1970s, it never would have worked because the consciousness of people at that stage and the perhaps, you know, people's resilience and independence from the state was at a much higher level. And so it would not have worked. And yeah, quite exactly what you say. All of these things have got to be combined, and they use them in synergy against the population. So you have to, anything which has, you know, great power, whether it's religion or science or the monetary system, technology, etc. I mean, they'll be corrupted because the people who have nefarious goals realize that that's what you have to control, you know, and all of these institutions get corrupted because of that reason. And I mean, health is such an important thing. It's, you know, it's one of those things that people rank up there highly. So it was only natural that they were going to corrupt the quote health system in virtually every country in the world. But yeah, it's I think at the same time though, there's people should never underestimate what they can do as individuals. And you know, in 2020, I think not many people started speaking up, but when they did, like it didn't take long to get hundreds of thousands or millions of views around the world, and for people to go, okay, yeah, I can see this is a scam. And I always think it takes less people than you know, might be imagined. And you know, it's like something like face masks. If people are out and about and 100% of people are wearing face masks, they tend to keep them on. But if they see that 20% of us are not bothered, we're not wearing them, then it gives them a little bit of a thought. Oh, okay, that's cool. Maybe I don't have to wear one too. And you know, my point is that despite the fact that we can probably be in these eras where you know, consciousness is very low, or you know, things are pretty despondent. We should never underestimate that each individual can make quite a difference, you know. And we're seeing it more and more with the feedback we're getting from people who say, you know what, I was on an airplane the other day, and I noticed a politician across the aisle, and you know, I asked him, why did you do lockdowns? And you know, and just getting a response from them to see if they actually knew anything about why they did the things they did. And you know, that's great that people are starting to question these officials and alleged high priests of science in various institutions, etc. So yeah, I think we should always stay optimistic. I mean, I know personally myself, I've seen some pretty funny things, despite the darkness in the last 4 years, with how much difference one person can actually make.
Do you have a sense that coming up here, maybe even in the latter part of this year, that there'll be another test on us in terms of the lessons that we've been able to harvest the past 4 years, in the sense that there may be another attempt to do something like another lockdown, so-called Disease X? I mean, we know that there is also this move to sort of maneuver towards an end game in the form of the Pandemic Preparedness Treaty, which is going to be an attempt to like basically mandate all the moves that they were originally trying to implement in 2020, as sort of like at the level of the WHO, there's now a binding agreement that if we, label something a pandemic, then we have the authority to mandate that we have basically control of everybody's body, et cetera. Do you have a sense that there is going to be another big test, an attempt to do this, and we'll see how many people were able to harvest the lessons of the past 4 years? Or what are your thoughts on these kind of things that are coming out of the World Health Organization and the sort of speculation about another pandemic?
Yeah, again, I just think this is driving fear narratives, and I wouldn't take it too seriously, because if enough people are awake, there's nothing they can do against civil disobedience. We've known this for, centuries. It's like when kings used to try and tax more than a few percent, people would just say, "No, stop that, I'm not doing it," and they'd risk a complete rebellion, So they have a problem, and in COVID, they pushed it way too far. They lost control, which is why we had police on the streets and riot gear beating the public. We had them firing on their own civilians and all this kind of craziness. And while people got, it was awful to be watching that, and it happened, in some of our cities, etc. But at the same time, we could see that they were losing control, because when you've got control of the narrative, you don't have to expend much energy anymore. People are just going along with it on their own accord, and they're policing each other. But when there's too many people questioning it, that's when they send the military and the police on the streets and start threatening people with, worse and worse persecution, etc. So, and I mean, in the middle of COVID, you probably saw that they tried to launch monkeypox, but that completely fizzled. They declared it a pandemic. They started saying there's emergencies going on, and people started making jokes straight away. Like, even people that didn't fully appreciate the fraud of virology, etc., they could still see a scam. And that's why the monkeypox thing couldn't really take off, back in 2022. So, and I also think, I'm not sure if you've read The Great Taking by David Rogers Webb, but he talks about the great financial clearinghouse they're trying to create, this WF dream that they have, that they're going to own everything and you'll own nothing. And he talks about the legislation that's being put out in every country in the world, basically, to allow one giant clearinghouse to take ownership of everything. But as he points out, they've got so desperate, it's not going to work. They don't possibly have the capacity to enforce this kind of thing. They're not going to be able to take ownership of all of our properties and possessions, etc. And David Rogers Webb points out in his book, the reason it's falling apart is exactly what I'm saying, is because there were cops on the street. They wouldn't have done that unless they were losing control. And so, no, I think too many people are awake now. I think there was, if you read the various white papers and publications leading up to 2019, 2020, because they were planning this event, they knew that there was going to be resistance, but they classified the resistance as anti-vaxxers. They didn't classify the resistance of people going, germ theories are fraud, viruses don't exist, governments don't have authority to do this, people starting to realize that there's that the sovereignty thing is all false, etc. It's opened up to, and people are realizing that the financial system is a fraud, fractional reserve banking, the inflation that they use, that governments and banks use to steal off the population every year. Too many people are becoming aware of this stuff now. And I think that's That was inadvertent. I don't think they intended that to happen with COVID. I think they thought that it would keep people suppressed and would make them more compliant, etc. And although temporarily it maybe it did, I think it woke up way too many people. So I think if they do try something again with the disease X, there'll be this time probably, I mean, we can't predict the future, but probably I'd say too many people not going along with it. And it's interesting, Alex, because even this year, we're being contacted by people who said that they heard about Sam and I 4 years ago and they thought we were nuts, and or they'd heard other people talking about us, dismissing us and saying that we don't have any decent material. They've started looking at it and have said, oh my goodness, this is incredible. Some of these people took four COVID jabs. They were taking them up till late last year. And they're just saying now that they've fully woken up, or at least partially woken up and realizing that COVID was a complete scam. So, no, I think things are moving in a direction where it's going to be incredibly hard for them to pull something off that's similar. I'm not saying they won't try it, but I think it will be dismantled in real time, because at the early 2020, a lot of us were scrambling to start dissecting the material, etc. But now, if whatever disease X, many of us have already written articles. We talk about it in our new book, about the scam of disease X, how it's basically been a marketing funnel for the Eco Health Alliance and Peter Daszak's groups, etc. Because these are billion-dollar industries, because that's the other thing that's taken place, is this great transfer of wealth from the population to these corporations and globalist entities in the last 4 years. I mean, the public's been completely swindled and they've come out poorer. Cost of living's gone up in virtually every country in the world, and a lot of these corporations are at all-time record profit levels. So yeah, I think you know what? I think that COVID, they overreached and they blew it, and that relates to the bigger picture going on. They're trying to cover up financial fraud, etc. So I guess we'll see. We'll see what happens. But let's just keep, spreading the word and telling people that they don't have to buy into this stuff, that they can completely ignore it. And many of us that ignored what happened, with the lockdowns and stuff, found that you can pretty much go about your business. Keep in mind that we outnumber the police and military by hundreds of times in general. There's way too many of us that we, if they're doing silly things, we don't have to go along with it. And I'm not saying people, look, we've had friends that have been thrown in jail for periods of time, and that happens, but then they get out again and continue doing what they do. And yeah, I think there's, let's take it that COVID was a sign of complete desperation from the deep state and these other entities that have these nefarious goals.
All right, well, before we go, I just want to plug your new book. It's called The Final Pandemic. It just came out about a month or two ago, and it's co-written with your wife, Sam or Samantha. And I was wondering if we could just go over real quick, like what your aims for this particular book was and how you see it fitting in with the overall literature of this field that some of your peers have put out. Let's start with that. Where do you want the final pandemic to fit into the larger sort of end of COVID community and some of the other work that's been done?
Yeah, well, the idea with The Final Pandemic was, a book that wasn't too arduous for new readers to take on. We obviously wanted something that our existing audience could enjoy as well, and that's why we put all new material in there. But basically, it was like something that you could give to someone as a stepping stone into this world of, fraudulent virology, germ theory, allopathic medicine, etc. So, we've broken it down into sub chapters, which can be read, relatively easily. You don't need a huge background in science or medicine or anything. And just really taking it is a historical journey. Like, we do look back to the 1800s and how they used to make mistakes thinking everything were germs, and how that led to all sorts of problems in the past. But also just looking at like headlines that people will be familiar with, because, these are New York Times and Washington Post and Guardian, etc. articles that people would have seen in 2020 and later years. And it's just showing that, look, let's just go back through these articles and headlines and point out just how preposterous they were. Absolutely no evidence whatsoever of the claims in the headlines. And I think with a fresh pair of eyes, people looking at these photographs again and these headlines, and then with us just walking through some of the science behind it, or lack of science, I should say, people can see, oh my goodness, it was absolutely preposterous what they sold us in the year 2020. Now, obviously, we do write technical papers as well, and people in the book, we reference technical papers if people want to get into the details. But the idea with the book was just to give an overview of things like COVID-19, polio, HIV, etc., and just point out, look, there's absolutely no evidence for these things, and essentially they revolve around these marketing campaigns and fear narratives. And we talk about the people that benefit from these narratives. We also talk about our own experiences in the system, because people always say, well, how can everyone be in on it? And it's not a case of everyone being in on it. You only have to have a couple of things that you slip by, anti-scientific principles, and then you'll get entire industries like doctors, etc., who will continue to propagate these myths. And a lot of it's to do with financial incentives. So we have some sub chapters in there just talking about the financial incentives as well, and our own experiences of coming from that system, and what doctors are expected to do, and what happens to doctors like us when you start to speak out, or doctors like Paul Thomas, who published data about how his vaccinated patients were not doing as well as the unvaccinated ones. And instead of welcoming his contributions, they decide to strike him off and put him, through a prosecution. So, yeah, we just talk about, the playing field, the marketing narratives, the lack of science behind any of their claims. And this book was really, the idea of it was, Sam's book she co-authored, Virus Mania, which is a huge book. It's like 480 pages. It's got over 1,400 references. And the feedback we get is that for some people, it's just too much to take that first step into this world. It's too much scientific information in one go. So this book is just over half the size. This book's about 50,000, 55,000 words. So, it's something that someone could easily read in a week. They can pop it on the coffee table and just pick up. And it's, as I say, it's not designed to be a technical refutation. It's designed so that anyone can read it. And we've got about 450 references in there, so people can go to all of these articles and they can come to our website, and see there's a lot of free material
Yeah,
there,
you
and
have
the
another
book
one that I
will.
read when it came out a year or two ago called A Farewell to Virology. Is that a more like dealing with the same topics but goes a little bit more technical?
That's a technical paper, yeah, and I did try and make it easy to understand, but it does, in parts, it gets quite technical, and for people that are new to the topic, it's probably not something they'd want to start with, because it's virology basically, and analyzing virology papers. But yeah, so I see a final pandemic as like a good, not only for people to fully understand the fraud that just took place with COVID-19, so there's a lot of topical stuff, but also understanding the bigger picture of how we got to this point, why it seems like so many people are in on it when that's not really what's going on. And just to open those ideas in people's minds that we're not getting sick because of germs, and we don't need to take vaccines, we don't need to take all of these pharmaceuticals, etc. That's not the way forward.
So what's your outlook for the rest of this year looking like for you and Sam? Are you, now that you have this book out, I'm sure there was a lot of work that went into that. Do you feel like burnt out from spending so many years now, 4 years intensely in the virology field? Do you feel drawn towards something else, or do you feel like that you're still fully invested in all, the rest of this year is towards this battle?
I think, it's one of those things where there's interviews, there's podcasts, there's Substacks, etc., all refuting the virus model. And that's great. It's getting the message out there. But I also think there does need to be written work, which is why we do the technical papers and the books. And they are a lot of work, definitely. But I think it's really important because, you know, someone might post this interview that you and I are having, and oh, they'll say, oh, they don't know about this and they don't talk about that, and I'm an expert at it. And we can always say, well, if you want to look at that, then look at one of the technical papers. We're just having a chat here, you know. So I think it is important, and we will keep working on the technical stuff. Sam and I have a 6 month or more backlog of questions from our audience, and we've now started doing twice monthly question and answers to try and get through. But no, in terms of we've just got non-stop topics because as well as doing the virology and the germ theory stuff, we tackle basically most elements of health and well-being. And so yeah, no, we have every week we've just got content that we can put out. So yeah, it was interesting because when we started doing this in 2020, we thought, oh, will we eventually run out of ideas? But as our audience got bigger, we just started getting more and more feedback, more and more topics that people wanted us to research. So yeah, although, yep, it'll definitely be a theme of ours to keep doing these refutations of virology, et cetera. But also, yeah, week to week, Sam puts out a video every week. We do the question and answers twice a month. And yeah, Alex, I just see years of work ahead. And when I say work, to us, it doesn't really, it just feels like the journey that we're on. And, you know, I quit medicine back in 2016 is when I got completely out of the system. And yeah, I thought I'd never have anything to do with it again. And I just accepted that, you know, I'd trained, I'd become fully qualified as a doctor. I did postgraduate qualifications, et cetera. And I thought, okay, it was a mistake. I shouldn't have done it, but I was happy to get out of it. And then in 2020, I found this new phase to, and this doesn't feel like work. Like, you know, when I used to be at university and I had to write like a 3,000 word essay, I'd be like, oh no, this is so annoying and stuff. And then when I wrote a farewell to virology, that was 30,000 words, and it just poured out of me. It took me about 4 months to write it. I wasn't seeking money or anything, and I published it for free. And now it's been downloaded off our website more than a quarter of a million times, and it's a real thrill that's got out there into the world, and far more views than most things on The Lancet or the New England Journal of Medicine would ever achieve. And so, no, to us, it doesn't feel like work. It more just feels like a really fascinating. We're just so grateful that despite all the bad things that happened with COVID-19 and how they've tried to keep prosecuting Sam here in New Zealand, etc., for us, it's been we're grateful that we've been able to discover our calling, which was to help people get over these misplaced beliefs and fears. And we really hope that books like The Final Pandemic can reach more and more people, and they can move out of that fear-based paradigm and into something a better world, basically, in so many ways. And yeah, it keeps us going.
It's amazing that you and Sam, you were saying it was only since 2020. And I'm just kind of interested now to hear a little bit about what brought you out of medicine in 2016. But you were saying earlier that 2020, you guys both seemingly at the same time got put onto the critique of germ theory and both immediately embraced it. And it's really cool to see how you guys work as a team and you seem to be like completely on the same page. Was there like how did that work in 2020 when you first got on to this critique of germ theory and this sort of shattering of an old way of thinking and about medicine that you've both been trained in? Like, was there any friction at first about one person? Did one person make the first move and there was some resistance, and then eventually they're like, oh, okay, I'm with you now? Or how did that work, that dynamic work? Because a lot of couples split apart because of the difference in attitude about about what was happening and their reaction to it. And like we're saying, some people just aren't ready to let go of that old paradigm. So what was that dynamic like? Because it's really cool to see you guys working now, you know, so tightly as a team and are completely on the same page. Was that always the case, or was there ever any tension about these new ideas coming in and what they would end up doing to your, the way that they would end up taking your life in this new direction?
Yeah, well, I mean, I left medicine in 2016 because I didn't believe in it anymore. And, I used to be at work and think in my clinics that I wouldn't want to do these things that we're supposed to do. I wouldn't do them to my family or my own body. And, I was never really happy with pharmaceuticals, et cetera. I'd question the use of vaccines when I was a medical student because I hadn't had all the vaccines, and I had to get on to clinical training because I got called up and they said, our records show that you haven't had some of these vaccines. And I really didn't want to get some of them, but I did in the end because otherwise I couldn't start work as a doctor. So there was all these kind of speed bumps along the way. And in 2016, I'd had a couple of years where I was just sitting on the fence and just thinking, I really don't think I should do medicine anymore. In 2016, I said to Sam, I think you should get out as well. And I said, I think this whole paradigm is broken. And not only with the quote science that was being espoused, but just the regulations of it as well, and how you're basically forced to say certain things and do certain things. You don't have autonomy as a practitioner. If you want a license, then you have to toe the line. But Sam had, she had a research job that she really loved, and the patients all loved her there. And then she also became a mainstream, it seems strange, but in 2019, she was a mainstream TV presenter as well. And that caused problems in 2020. They took her off the air because she went off the script in terms of started telling people that COVID was a scam. And the TV network, obviously, they canned the whole series that she was in. But no, in 20, what happened was that, in early 2020, Sam set up the YouTube channel, and she just had this idea that she'd just talk about, medical topics, and just based on what she'd had at that stage, about 14 years she'd been in the system, and 13 years or something, and thought, okay, well, with my experience as a doctor, I can just start talking about it on YouTube. And her channel got really popular really quickly. But of course, in early 2020, it coincided with the COVID era. And very quickly, people started just saying, can you research COVID? And can you research this whole thing about this new virus? And so Sam quickly got overwhelmed with all the questions and said to me, can I help her with the research? And I said, yep, sure.
And what were you doing at the
And
time? Like, what did you moved into instead when you moved out of medicine?
well, essentially I retired in 2016 because I hated medicine so much that the day I graduated, I started investing a lot in property. My brother is in construction, and we formed a partnership, and we were building and accumulating properties, etc. And we did that pretty successfully. So when I turned 40 in 2016, I didn't really have to work anymore, and that was what I'd aimed to do because I really just had to get out of medicine. So I had no intention of kind of coming back into it. We started doing things like homeschooling our kids
Okay, great.
intermittently. I brought them home for a year. I think that may have been around 2018. I homeschooled our two oldest kids for a year. And yeah, I was taking care. We had a huge garden, like an award-winning garden. So I was looking after that. I was taking care of the kids a lot, just spending lots and lots of time with them, doing sport. And no, I was always busy, and then just running the investments, et cetera, but completely out of medicine. But then in early 2020, Sam's video channel on YouTube starts taking off, and she said, everyone's asking about COVID. That's the main question I'm getting. And she said, can you start helping me with the research? And I said, yeah. And in February 2020, I think it was around that time, I downloaded this WHO document, and I couldn't believe it that they'd made all these claims about what was going on, and there was no scientific references like for the proof that any of this was happening. And then we looked at one of the first papers that came out of Wuhan. And I was going, oh my God, this is incredible. There's no controls. They don't have evidence of this. This is just, they take fluid from one person's lungs and then claim that there's a new disease and a quote new virus. And I said to Sam, I think this is like really dodgy. And then we got a copy of Virus Mania. And this is before Sam was a co-author. We got the first edition, and that was around March or something. And I sat Sam down and I said, look, I think that that viruses don't exist. There's no evidence for them. And she was like, had 100 questions. And I said, look, heaps of these questions have been answered, it seems, like already. Like these researchers and groups like the Perth Group have done this really detailed analysis, blowing this stuff out of the water. And I said, I think everything we've been taught was wrong. And I said, I'm convinced, I'd research this for a few weeks. And I said, I think they've really got something here. And I said, I think you need to tell the world that this is fake, this whole thing. So in order to keep her YouTube channel, she started making videos, which didn't, you had to keep within the community guidelines, which,
Yeah,
like I
I've got
said.
two strikes on my channel. If I talk about COVID again, like this is not going to go on YouTube. This is going to go on my Substack and the podcast, but you can't talk about it's like this is the you know that this is the crux of where a lot of things, a lot of action is this topic because you can't talk about it. Like you can talk about Wuhan, you can talk about a bunch of other stuff, you can be critical of almost anything, but you cannot talk about germ theory and virology. They will take it down immediately.
Yeah, and that's what we found. Yeah, that saying that viruses don't exist is a sure way to lose your channel. And so what Sam did was just often put videos out there, just getting the audience to question things and saying, isn't this funny? Look at this study, etc. But yeah, no, Alex, we were just on board with each other right from the start. And I mean, Sam knew with me that I never ever start talking about something unless I've already researched it. Otherwise, I'll just tell people I'm not prepared to comment on that. So, previously I'd done detailed investigations into the financial system, like just over here on my bookshelf. When I investigated economics, I got 50 books on the topic, and read them all because I don't like to start talking about something unless I'm really clear that I've got depth of knowledge and have, really explored it. So when I said to Sam, I think this whole virology thing's a scam, she knew that I was not just flippantly coming up with some idea, that I'd really looked at the vital stuff. So yeah, no, we just were completely in sync with it. And as I say, it was not my intention to get involved. She'd just set up the YouTube channel, and then she said, oh my goodness, I've got like thousands of subscribers now and they're all asking me questions. And as I say, it became overwhelming, and then people started wanting to interview her and talk to her and get her to do speeches and stuff. And it just got so busy for her that I was just working full time basically in the background researching. And especially in 2020, I had to come up to speed with, like, I was reading like virology textbooks and 100-page documents on genomics and stuff. I really had to get up to speed with what we were doing. So yeah, and I think no, we pretty much, yeah, we really seem to agree on, I think it's that paradigm you get into though, like, whether you want to call it the terrain paradigm. Or, I guess people would call us naturopaths now. It's once you're in that paradigm, everything just fits together. And I know what you mean. We had friends who ended up having divorces during the COVID era because one would say, I think it's a scam, and the other would be completely freaking out, saying it's not, it's real. And yeah, unfortunately, we did see that actual couple separating. But no, for Sam and I, it was, we embrace the opportunity, and both of us have just, we love what we do now. It's finally a form of, our quote medical careers. Not that we really have them, but it feels like we're doing the right thing, and it feels like we're both doing the right thing, and we have this real synergy too. I mean, you know the style of work that we do. I tend to write technical stuff, and
Mm-hmm.
Sam makes it easy to understand for the audience. So, like, I'll say to Sam, "Look, we've got this. This is what we need to present." And Sam's going, "I'm falling asleep just listening to it, so I can't present that to the audience." She said, "Maybe for a few people who are really experts in this area." She said, "But I've got to make it more fun. You know, I've got to make it more accessible for the audience." So she's got that real sense of, and she has reached a lot of people, like, you know, arguably of all the no virus proponents, I don't know that many have reached more than Sam. And she's also taken very serious work, like the Perth Group's work on HIV, and she's brought tens of thousands of new people into seeing that work. So that's really important as well, to, you know, act as a conduit to show people. And we found too that humor is like the ultimate kind of, once you can make jokes about something, that's usually when you fully understand what's going on. And that's why often the videos, we put a bit of you know, a bit of humor in some of them to try and lighten things up a bit. But no, I can say there's very few things that we disagree with. The most common thing is, you know, we're just about to put the final edit on a video, and one of us will have some problem with some small thing, like it'll be a quote or a meme or just the way some of the audio works or something. So it's all minor stuff. It's never anything big.
Well, it's amazing. I mean, to go from, you know, March 2020, first getting onto this to what you guys have accomplished since then. I mean, you guys really hit the ground running. I found Sam's stuff in 2020, so I've been following your work since then. And I mean, you've got this major paper, A Farewell to Virology, that came out a couple years ago. You participated in the End of COVID, which we haven't talked about that yet, but that was this major launch with a lot of people in this community came together to create like this comprehensive curriculum. People can find that if you just search the End of COVID. Co-authored this sort of second edition of Virus Mania. And then now you have this new book, The Final Pandemic, which is out on Amazon. And so congrats to you guys. Really great work. I really appreciate what you've done. And dude, come back sometime and let's do an economics deep dive. Let's go into that, because I've been wanting to talk about that more coming up, and to do my own deep dive into it. So I think that'd be great. But I'll let you go for now, man. I really enjoyed the conversation. I appreciate you joining me. And yeah, thank you very much.
No, it's been a real pleasure, Alex. And it's one of the best things I think that happened with the whole COVID situation was coming into contact with people like yourself, because, you know, we would never have met probably unless they did this crazy COVID maneuver. So that's, I just take all of these things as something to be grateful for. And I hope your audience members too can see that no matter how dark things are, we've got to see the positive side, and we've all got to try and make the world a better place. So thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
All right, cheers, mate. God bless. Thank you.
Thanks, Alex.
Thank you.